Welcome to the Fat Emperor podcast. I'm your host, Ivor Cummins. We're supported by the Irish Heart Disease Awareness Charity, which advocates a simple CT scan to reveal your CAC score. So know your score and take action to prevent that premature heart attack. Everything you need to know will be right here. I'm here with Dave Feldman today, who many of you will know, and we're going to discuss the current crisis that's enveloped the world, the coronavirus issue. And we're going to look at various aspects, some of the data, we're both engineers, but also some of the personal impacts and the broader kind of context. So great to see you, Dave, again.
Likewise, Ivor. Things have changed a bit since we saw each other last.
Yeah, I guess. It's a different world, as they say. But it'd be great to discuss some of the data and the impacts, because it goes way beyond just the physiological impacts and obviously the illness and death that will occur, and into the whole economy and how this affects people in so many vectors.
Absolutely. And like just about any other media that's being recorded right now, we should announce the date. This is being recorded on March 21st, because of course, as you know, data is changing so rapidly, literally by the day. In fact, I was just reflecting on the fact that this is 2 weeks ago, I was mulling about whether I would be going to Low Carb Denver, because I had still had planned to go. I had had a whole bunch of interviews lined up, a lot of biggies that were going to be on for the documentary that you know I'd been filming. And I ultimately decided tomorrow, 2 weeks ago, to not go to Low Carb Denver. And what I thought at the time was an abundance of caution, because I had been traveling all around the world, that just the mere chance that I might, you know, be an asymptomatic carrier for coronavirus, I thought it'd be better if I stayed home. And it was heartbreaking, because I thought, you know, I would just be one of the very few that might not end up at Low Carb Denver. And lo and behold, things rapidly changed within just a few days. To where there was a lot more seriousness applied, you know, across the country, really across the world. And it's really kind of amazing, because I think for many people who are listening to this now, these last 2 weeks don't feel like 2 weeks at all. It feels like we've been in this for a much longer span of time.
Yeah, well, for sure, Dave. I mean, the intensity in the past week or so has escalated so much that I'm sure there's a time dilation effect, and people are stuck at home, and it's such a different experience. But I wonder, would you prefer to start with some of the data, again, keeping it reasonably high level for the audience, or the experiential side? Maybe some of the data first. And, you know, there are some kind of scary things in the data, but also I've noticed in the past week or so, looking closer at this, there's also some reassuring things in the data in many ways.
I definitely think so. And I mean, we should go ahead and kind of, I like to do the bad news first and then work my way towards the good news. Certainly the bad news is that I've been, and let me qualify first, I'm not a statistician or anything at the higher level of math. So yeah, I've been running a lot of the data to observe just how much our growth is linear versus exponential. And the rate of change is definitely suggestive that it's exponential, for that matter, that it's exponential at a rate that is certainly concerning, that we're going to be seeing a very large increase of cases, in fact, to such a degree that we'll probably exceed our testing capacity at some level. It depends on how fast we ramp up the testing, particularly here in the United States. And yes, right now I started looking at this data when it had about 120,000 cases worldwide, 80,000 of those cases being China. So we had about 40,000 cases at that time. Now, by my current count, our total excluding China, so no longer 40,000, we're up at around 117,000. And again, that's just been in a week and a half, that's been relatively rapid in its progression. And if you look at the top countries, you'll find that almost all of them have this exponential curve, save South Korea, which I'd like to be able to talk about a little bit more in detail later. And part of the problem is when you're on an exponential curve of incoming new cases, it then becomes sort of difficult to get a real sense of what the rates of, say, ICU care is needed, or for that matter, even fatalities, because so many of the incoming new cases keep pushing down those rates on the existing cases by comparison.
Yeah, there's a lag as such. So you've got the death rates for today, but you know the cases are changing and there's a lag of a couple of weeks. I thought South Korea was good because they did so much widespread testing that they had a better idea of cases versus fatality than many other countries.
That's right. They're over, I believe they're over 300,000 tested. They're several thousand per million per of their population. And that's, I mean, on a per capita basis, they're just absolutely killing it. And it's not just the level of testing. They're very adamant about tracking those people who they know have not only been confirmed to have gotten the virus, but all of those people that they had exposure to. And I do want to say that there's also a little bit more of a kind of assumed partnership between the populace and the government. They kind of consider this, they're a little bit closer in that regard. And it should be said that there's also a little bit of a cultural difference to many of us in the West, for example, that they tended to be a lot more mindful of viruses to begin with. Also on a per capita basis, there's more face masks, for example. A lot of families already would have, say, one face mask or several, depending on the flu season as it came, because it's just something that they're very cognizant of. So they don't, right now in South Korea, they don't have the same degree of lockdown that we're experiencing in the West to try to, because for them locally, they appear to have it under better control, relatively speaking. They seem to have passed their inflection point, at least as so far. Now, that said, as with any other country and as with any other situation, they may end up still seeing another hump. There may be further cases that they haven't yet detected, but given that they've done 300,000 tests already for how small their country is, I like their data a lot for where I feel like we should be going.
Yeah, and I think they are kind of a role model for the data, the approach, and everything. And I think Japan, though, also in Tokyo, it's still crammed with people. They're taking more of a Korean approach, all right, with intense testing, perhaps. But there are some of these countries that seem to be managing it very well without kind of dragging everything down or collapsing everything. It seems to be the case.
Yeah, and for what it's worth, I mean, again, let's talk just a little bit about sort of the cultural differences and the incubation time and how that becomes relevant to this larger story. So how likely is it that Ivor, you and I, when we would meet, might, you know, if one of us were infected, we'd pass on the other? Probably pretty high, because you know, I tend to be either a handshaker or a hugger, particularly a hugger if it's somebody who I'm really close with. And that is going to be like a behavior of a bygone era, eventually, particularly depending on how well you know the other person. Whereas if I'm in Japan, that would be considered very rude, right? It's much more acceptable to bow. And for that matter, you're less likely to, and I know this from a lot of my friends in Japan, there's a lot less, I think, sharing beyond where you're already going to have to share space. For example, the public transit are somewhat famous for you're being in a position where you have to share space a lot more. But all that said, like in the case of the public transit, you tend to see a lot more people wearing masks, particularly if they themselves, they're feeling they have a cough. They feel that it's very rude to blow your nose in public, to cough in public, and if possible, you know, you want to have a mask on so that you don't make other people uncomfortable, or for that matter, genuinely not, you know, spread the virus further. That behavior already being kind of built in, culturally speaking, I think helps to reduce the amount of spread. And I think that's, you know, I think to some degree, we're certainly going to be adopting some of these behaviors moving forward, especially at the height of this thing.
Yeah, and indeed we are, of course, all across the Western world, even beyond that. I mean, social distancing is underway. In Ireland, it's being largely observed. And, you know, the older people are very cognizant of another thing we have to talk about, the most at risk. So a bit like with heart disease and calcification scan, you know, the most at risk are the key group. And it would appear that there's this, I don't know if I should use the word enormous, but I think I will use the word enormous, that over 65s with actual conditions, medical conditions, or metabolically unhealthy are enormously higher than under 65s, especially with no medical conditions. So I'm kind of roughly thinking if you get under 65s with no conditions, metabolically healthy, they could be maybe in the region of 100 times or two orders of magnitude less of risk of serious complications than older people with comorbidities. This seems to me a very important point for people to realize, to realize who's most at risk and ensure absolutely that they are kept safe.
Yeah, we kind of talked a little bit about this off air, and I know on Twitter we've sort of bounced back and forth as to our level of concern in containment, particularly for social distance. And I think you made a point that certainly is one we need to keep in mind this whole time, which is how much are we bringing economic productivity to a standstill while trying to control this virus? And I think it actually was the United Kingdom that was initially seeking to try to quarantine those people of a more advanced age that were of a much higher risk while letting more of the rest of the populace sort of continue with, keeping up the engine of productivity, but has, if I'm to understand correctly, has changed gears quite a bit, right?
Yeah, and just a clarifying kind of aspect to that. So I think my perception is, for what it's worth, the UK had the gist of what I just said a minute ago, but it was not applied properly and it was applied way too late. So if a few weeks ago, given the obviousness of almost of what was going to happen, because we knew it was very transmissible and, you know, it's going to cross borders. If a few weeks ago they had done a lockdown, extremely strong application of people with medical conditions, over 65s, etc., it may have been viable. But I think doing it so late and not really enforcing it, but just talking about it, you know what I mean? Too little, too late for that strategy. So I'm almost perceiving now that the next 2 or 3 weeks of total distancing is going to be required anyway to compensate for the slowness in reacting. That's kind of how I'm viewing it. We're going to need a couple of weeks of total, but then hopefully when things are under some control and we can see the level of burden on the hospitals, maybe they can relook again at a strategy that can keep the economy running, herd immunity possibly developing in the younger, healthier, while keeping the most at risk safe. I'm wondering, is that play something that could develop as more data comes in over a couple of weeks?
It's certainly something I've been putting a lot of thought towards. I've tried to think out a lot of different scenarios, and I think you and I as engineers, we're used to being in systems management situations. And as such, whether we're managers or whether reporting to managers, we're usually having to talk out outcomes. And that includes a lot of outcomes we don't want to have happen. In fact, You're basically not a good engineer if you're not doing that, right? So you need to be rapidly, coming to an understanding of what the worst case scenario is that's of some realistic potential. And unfortunately, we're in a situation where there's a lot of those that we would not have even been thinking about a few weeks ago. And this is one of those, which is, okay, we quarantine everybody. We want to not have a system shock that's going to, be over, say, several weeks, much less months, where there's a lot of loss of productivity, a lot of people not being able to work at their jobs and keep the economy rolling. But at the same time, what does happen if our hospitals are genuinely and truly overloaded to the extent where it doesn't look like we're really gaining control as we would like to think control would be, where, the queues are starting to go down and where there's more and more people that are now getting a ventilator who need one? We don't really have a good answer for that. But this is the one thing where I kind of want to inject a little bit of hope. In our lifetimes, we've never, ever seen this many brilliant people all across the globe, all working on one problem, collaborating together with a level of technology that they've never had before, to be able to share data and achieve a level of problem solving that, you know, in a sense, this is kind of the new experiment, right? That it's true, something like a vaccine is probably far off. You know, the issues with a clinical trial, we really are playing with Mother Nature. We really do need to be sure we don't hurt more people than we help. Vaccines are a tricky one, but already there have been lots of different drugs that have already been approved, that have already been applied to some cases, for which there seems to be some positive outcomes. There really does need to be a lot more done to determine efficacy. But that's, I try to weigh how much these worst case scenarios are with some of the best case scenarios that we don't yet know about, but for which we're seeing some green shoots.
Yeah, and you know, the vaccine is kind of the best case, a very effective vaccine, but it's a long way out. 12 to 18 months is generally the figures quoted. But in the short term, in any crisis management, going back to engineering, you always look for rapid mitigators. They're not the perfect solution. They're not root cause fixed, but you need fast mitigators to deal with the onslaught, exactly like this. And I think hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine itself, they've shown in actual human trials, admittedly not randomized, coming out of France, small trials, kind of extraordinary results in the circumstances. You'd expect nothing in the first few weeks to be really discovered. And there are many more also, which I won't mention. But it looks like, yeah, there are mitigating meds with very good potential. And I hope that these are being applied kind of pretty rapidly, especially when they're old meds that the established side effects are known. So you can use them with a lot of kind of knowledge and authority. I heard that particular one is being banned from export from the UK from several days ago. And President Trump has also actually announced it as being exploratory. So these are great green shoots, like you say. They could really help keep the impact down while this is being managed.
Yeah, and it's, again, to the degree with which we'll be able to apply these, you know, tomorrow, obviously that's somewhat limited. We don't really know how fast we can get something approved, for that matter, how fast it is that we're getting it in mass production. But we can be sure that there's a level of motivation that we've never quite seen before. And therefore, I think a lot of the red tape and the bureaucracy will certainly be relaxed to the extent to where it was problematic before. And there'll be a lot, again, hopefully more competent minds that are in charge of making this thing move toward itself.
Yeah. And actually, hydroxychloroquine as opposed to hydroxychloroquine that I said. But yeah, one of the major pharmaceutical manufacturers, I think it might be Sanofi or Novartis, they've donated 3 million tablets of this product. And I think the military stock it in large quantities because it's an anti-malarial. So I think it's probably something that can be rapidly accelerated. I did see an article yesterday, though, that the company, the prime company that makes it in the US, doubled the price in January when the demand from China shot up for this antiviral.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me too much. Mm. Now, I do want to say that we really should acknowledge there's a lot more bad news ahead before we can finally get to the good news. And we've experienced a lot of it this week. So, they're now up to, as of the point of this recording, they're now up to 4,000 deaths. Spain has really shot up very rapidly as well. They're at about a third of that, at 1,326 deaths as of the current count this morning. And these are real human lives. This is not even counting the people who right now are in the ICUs and that they're suffering. And I think that we'll never quite get used to that kind of news, but to some degree, we're going to kind of get used to this being a little bit of the new normal. I like the term the new normal because it's somewhat suggestive of how we are as a species, that we can tend to adapt to, you know, whatever times that we're in. for better and for worse. But that, yeah, unfortunately, while we need to be mindful, we need to understand what our part is to play as well. That, yeah. You know, a lot of these things are downstream of whether we intended to or not, that we've helped to spread this disease moving forward. Again, viruses are ultimately using us as the battleground. And that, I think, is something everybody needs to keep in mind to better understand what they can do to reduce the spread.
Yeah, and I can't help but being drawn back. I don't want to be a kind of single message person, and there's a huge tragedy involved in any or all deaths. But drawn back to the Italian report, you mentioned Italy, obviously a very high rate, and 99% had existing medical conditions, and the average age was 79.5. And many other countries, Switzerland also releasing similar data, there certainly will be younger. But I can't help but feel we kind of know now powerfully the enormously most important cohort at risk for the tragedies that you describe. And I wonder, is there consistency across the world on very targeted isolation engineering style of the most at-risk group, which would make up the vast majority of the tragedy and the system load? Is that happening really?
I think that there's more analysis being applied now. I saw the recent study that came out with the US in that I think it was 20% of those, is it 20%? No, I think it might have been 18%. That were admitted to the ICU with coronavirus were ages 20 to 44. So that's still like about a 1 in 8 that's going to be somebody much younger than we would expect it to be.
I might just interview, I saw that report this morning, but some professor sent it out, but he said between the ages of 20 and 65, and there was a kind of a discussion then that group was 80% of the population, or the under 65s were, so it kind of looked from the data that there was a 20 times more likelihood if you're over 65. And I think the other question is for that 20 to 45 or 65 group, I mean, we really need to take out the people who are at risk because of medical or metabolic issues, just for clarity, so people know what the age alone risk factor is versus, you know, whether or not there are conditions and stuff. I'm not sure that's in the data.
No, and for what it's worth, like I could kind of argue the biases on both sides. So on one end, older and people already metabolically compromised are probably more likely to seek help at a hospital in general. So there may already be a little bit of a front loading of the bias in that regard. That's a lot of what the discussion was with China's data, that perhaps a lot of it skewed toward the older because they already had not only just a higher likelihood of being admitted to the hospital by loved ones, but also they already would have more of an existing relationship. Whereas you might have a lot of people who under the same level of conditions, but say in their 20s, might think that it was something they just needed to tough out. That's one end. It's true. On the other end, I would say that it's possible that, you know, within the United States, especially if you've got a population for which there's just a higher proportion of those that are younger, you know, seeking help, that you may end up with something that would be skewed in the other direction. This is just sort of the challenge of trying to collect good data while a situation is so rapidly advancing. And that's, you know, that's something where both of us have to acknowledge there's really just not a lot of strong data that's, you know, randomized. We don't have things like, say, surveillance testing, which is just really an unfortunate thing right now, because surveillance testing in every country would be of enormous benefit if we could count on it.
Yeah, in fairness, no, there's error bars here. I've been just kind of triangulating all the countries, the different experiences, the practices, and the data, and just coming up with a broad feel. And it just strikes me how enormously the hard cases and tragic cases are weighted so heavily towards medical conditions and age. It's just something that I find hard to take out of my mind, even though there are error bars. Actually, Professor Ioannidis, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, wrote or released an editorial that was quite striking, but he emphasized exactly what you said. He said the current reactions are based on relatively very weak and variable data at this point, but it was kind of a hard-hitting review. Did you see that one or read it?
I think that I did, but I think it was in the middle of a stack of things. You know, as you were talking, I actually went and looked it up. So among the 121 patients, this is on the report that I was talking about before. Actually, I have to correct myself, 12% among adults aged 20 to 44. So it wasn't 18%.
I think it's 20 for 20 to 65, roughly, or 21, I think. So that'd tie in roughly.
Yeah, one of my concerns, Ivor, is that I do understand one of the challenges we have in hospitals getting overwhelmed is that there also is the potential lack of consistent data. And it's understandable. Like you already have doctors that were overwhelmed before all of this happened in having to, you know, fill out a lot of these electronic records, and the case reports would get somewhat cumbersome, especially to meet certain insurance targets and so forth. But unfortunately, the degree with which that may get deprioritized, even if it's understandable, may have impacts on how it is that we can see this disease from a larger scale. So it's going to be a challenge, not just in how it is that we can meet treatment goals, but in how it is that we can allocate staff effectively to get us the data for how it is that we can handle things for tomorrow.
Yeah, it's a quagmire, no doubt. And I noticed in England as well, one of my docs over there said they've sent home a couple of doctors who have kind of diabetes, medical conditions. So they're going to actually lose people as well in a preventative way by getting medical professionals who are at high risk out. And then some medical professionals are also maybe going to catch it and they'll be out of the system for a couple of weeks, increasing the load. But I presume they're using very good protective gear for the medical guys. So in other words, they really are protecting themselves from becoming part of the problem, I guess.
Well, I have to interject. This is a major problem. I know for sure in the United States, that's the PPE, as they would call it, has not, I mean, the demand has been off the charts. And unfortunately, there was something that I don't remember which organization released it, but that basically said, you know, if need be, somebody, a medical professional that might have been exposed could use, for example, a bandana as a means of use for a face mask. And this was understandably ripped into quite a bit by a lot of the existing doctors I follow. It's a challenge because you need the people to help with treatment, but at the same time, we're going to end up with a lot of shortage the more that we know that there's the exposure, particularly if we know they've tested positive.
Yeah, and I did come across that article now that you mention it, all right. And I can understand why it was said, you know, needs must better than nothing crisis, but it's not a good look, all right, because I'd say the effectiveness is pretty low for a bandana, unless you soaked it in some kind of alcohol or fluid, perhaps. But anyway, we're going down a hole there.
Yeah, so, nobody's going to wear that all day.
No. Well, unless people who really like alcohol, yeah. So, yeah, where it goes from here, there's a watch and wait in a sense. I guess the Western world and the way it is at the moment is there's pretty much a very strong global distancing, global lockdown. So in a couple of weeks, we'll get an idea of how this exponential is going, how much the hospitals are overloaded besides the respirator issue, but just in general sense. And then there'll be a bit more clarity on what the measure should be going forward.
Yeah, it's, again, rapidly changing situation. I think a lot of what we've just been talking about will be very key to better understanding what the next move is. For example, if we can achieve a ramping up manufacture of a lot of these medical supplies, as there may be, you know, a lot of this demand filled, but when is it filled? Is it going to be filled in a week to 2 weeks? Are we going to feel like at a minimum, the masks are coming up fast enough? But that's one vector. Another are the beds. And unfortunately, that's one of the biggest worries right now is that we're going to run out of beds, you know, across Europe, across the United States, and that it's going to get, you know, a lot more serious. There'll be a lot more people that are waiting to hopefully get a bed and who just may not be able to. And they're there may be a lot of decisions made as to how much things can be handled with home care and so forth for mitigation. You know, just as the Italian doctors have had to do, there may have to be you know, measures taken to determine you know, what cases are worth going for and which aren't. These are difficult topics to even be talking about out loud. But at the same time, I really do feel like it's, again, better to sort of run through these scenarios, better to plan for yourself and for your family to, you know, at what degree you want to mitigate for yourself, what decisions you want to make. For example, let's say that you have somebody who's potentially going to be needing care. You know, are you able to pick up sticks right now and move to where they're at in anticipation that you may be there? It's something you should be thinking about at this point in time.
Yeah, for sure. And there are other positive kind of noises, even around the hospital situation, but very prematurely. But I know an anaesthetist did tweet on, and I didn't have time to get into the details. The last day has been a bit off the wall. But I saw they had some innovative way of using equipment where they kind of got 7 or 9 people in a ventilator system for one basic set of equipment. And I didn't read it in detail, but it was very much retweeted. So I think there's going to be innovations as well where possibly corners are cut on the existing standard operating procedure because needs must. And, you know, standard beds at the moment are no good because you might need a ventilator per bed. But I'm guessing people are going to get creative too and take calculated risks to expand capacity. Or at least that's just the engineer in me. So I'm going to touch on something now that's a little controversial. I'll put my hand up and be honest. It's a little controversial and it may be a little too late now. But given the dramatic instances or rates of hypertension, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, and many different things associated with metabolic kind of insulin resistance type problems. If everyone, just as a thought experiment, don't get me wrong here, if everyone a few weeks ago across the world had just switched to completely real food, meat and veg diet, which we know has a dramatic reduction in insulin, glucose, and we have a almost majority diabetic population now, or pre-diabetic. Do you think that over the last few weeks could attenuate the severity of the next month or two? A lot, a little, medium, not really, it's too late to fix that stuff. What do you think?
So of course, Ivor, I am not a big fan of this question because I generally avoid the diet debates, even though I love talking about lipids. And obviously, I'm very much in the low carb space. But
Well, let's say then for purposes of this, and I agree totally. Let's say you could do something, anything, even a plant based or vegan. If you could do that for several weeks and it would have the effects that, say, the Virta trial did, where we know there's a dramatic reduction, but it could be
that's exactly where I was going. Yeah,
oh,
that's
great.
Look, whatever you do, make no mistake, it's worth it for you to try to stay healthy. It's worth it for you to encourage others you love to try to stay healthy. Look, right now, there's something a lot of people are doing, and it's understandable, which is that they're actually cheating more on their diet because they're finding comfort in food. So certainly a lot of shelf-stable food is bad food. If it can last in a package for months to years, not all of it's bad, but a lot of that food is bad. It's not good for your food. You should be proactive about trying to at least, you know, still visit the grocery store as much as you reasonably can get foods that are nutrient-rich that can rot. Because, you know, that's more likely going to be like vegetables. And yeah, I would say if you're on a plant-based diet and it's fruit, as long as you're staying healthier than if you weren't having it, I think that that's the direction to go. But it's about, you know, if there was ever one of those times where you say, hey, I'm going to diet like my life depends on it, I think there's probably no other span of time for so many of us that actually is going to turn out to be true. So yes, if you have insulin resistance, whatever way you get to health, and I think that there are many ways to get to health, you should really strongly consider not only going there, but staying there as much as you reasonably can.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, what caused the modern chronic disease epidemic, I mean, just kind of fixing that now over a couple of weeks is not going to do magic. There's no magic, right? But I might link afterwards, but Professor David Sinclair from Harvard and many others have actually discussed this topic, and pretty heavy hitting metabolic people. And they're kind of explaining why higher glucose and higher insulin actually would result in the dramatic things we're seeing, you know, the mechanisms. So I think it's a very logical thing. And like you say, there is no more important time in the last few decades than now to try and culture in yourself a greatly improved metabolic health. It's not a magic fix. It's not going to cure anything. It may greatly reduce your complications, though. And as we agreed earlier, it's the complications and the severe impacts in the minority that are really what's causing the whole problem. Just on a personal note, because I think, Dave, you mentioned earlier, you're going to talk a bit around the personal and real life family side of this, not just the data. My wife, as it happens, while I was in America, she bought another freezer along the lines of what we're talking about. And she filled it up with some seriously healthy grass-fed meat, frozen fruit, and all that stuff. But no processed food, you know, no sugar, refined carbs, seed oils, all real food in the freezer for the next few weeks.
That's great. Yes, it's certainly something I would encourage for other people. If you can get the food that you need to, you know, hunker down and quarantine for a while, then it's certainly something I think you should be doing. And odds are what you're putting in the freezer or what you're putting in the fridge is probably going to be better than what can sit on the shelf in your pantry. Again, it's more of a generalization because obviously I've got a lot of friends who are going to have, say, canned fish and things along those lines. But that's better than, say, you know, Twinkies or potato chips. I think if you're trying to survive, because here's the other issue that I think does need to get brought up. I think that with the lack of availability of variety of food, there's at least some degree with which we would have some, not maybe nutritional completion, but at least nutritional variety. I think that there'll be a lot of malnourishment with people who don't have much of a choice but to eat a lot of the same thing. I have a friend who the very first thing he shot toward was ramen noodles. So he thinks he's set because he's going to be basically only eating ramen noodles and he knows he has enough for several months. And I told him, look, do me at least a favor. Even though I don't tout vitamins, if I could at least get you to like take a multivitamin for, you know, just some level of insurance, just something, I would like you to at least do that. And I was happy I was able to at least talk him into that much. It's not going to prevent him from getting malnourished. But again, don't take this as an opportunity to eat the foods that you think are going to comfort you the most to take you through this crisis. It's important to stay healthy. I don't care what diet you're on. I don't care what lifestyle you're on. This is the best time. This is the most important time. If not for yourself, then for your loved ones who might also need your help.
Absolutely, Dave. And you know, I don't want to get into the supplement stuff either, but the interesting thing is that the supplements we would acknowledge are minerals, I'd prefer to say, and vitamins rather than supplements, like magnesium, potassium, sun UV exposure for vitamin D and for nitric oxide and other photo products, the health of that. And you can add in maybe selenium because of immune connections. But the supplements you might use anyway for lowered insulin resistance and improved health and lowered hypertension in general, they're kind of the same ones that you'd throw out to be healthier during this crisis. So it's not like there's any magic supplement for, you know, a virus. It's just any supplement you might take to optimize your health in the general sense will also broadly apply.
Yeah, and I think this comes up a lot in the space right now. There's a lot of people who will talk about things you can do to boost your immune system. And I agree with Dr. Campbell, in that I myself have never seen anything that boosts immune system, but I do see plenty of things that compromise immune system. So you should avoid that which is going to compromise your immune system. And unfortunately, we do know this. You know, metabolic syndrome is known for having many different things it compromises, and the immune system is one of them. The more your body is already trying to heal itself from the environment that you may or may not have been able to bring to it that resulted in the metabolic syndrome, the more that it has a difficulty with multitasking on the other fronts that other people have an easier time with, including mounting an immune response to a virus. So yeah, again, the key message, the key takeaway is to try to stay as healthy as you can. Again, look at it as a good excuse. Try to see the silver lining to it. If you ever needed a big kick in the butt, this should be it for you.
Yeah, this is the time. I think I put on a recent video I sent out. Now is the time to think more about this for sure. Something kind of a little quirky just occurred to me, and I'll throw it at you because it popped in my head. But when you were describing, it's not so easy to have nutritionally complete great foods stored for a long term, and your friend with the ramen noodles, it kind of occurred to me that people might be a little jealous of the carnivore crew right now because they've already switched over to something that's highly nutrient dense and they don't eat any of the bad stuff. Would that be fair to say?
I've already done a presentation where I was talking about my own personal challenges in doing an experiment that was plant-based versus carnivore. And, you know, again, this isn't me trying to pick favorites. It was easier, at least at the amino acid level, to hit the full complement of amino acids with, like, say, you know, 9 ounces of a ribeye steak. I was able to find ways that I could do it on a plant-based diet, and there's plenty of great resources online how to do that. But that was one challenge that kind of inhibited me from doing the experiment initially. I still intend, by the way, to eventually get back to that experiment, do a plant-based version. But it is true, some of the other nutrients, there really is a lot of nutrient density that comes with meat, particularly organ meat, that I think, you know, both sides will acknowledge to some extent. All of that said, you know, I wouldn't say one diet is the absolute favorite over the other. I will say that I would acknowledge in, you know, this conversation, it's kind of a little bit easier if you're having to choose one particular food stuff that you're going to, you know, pack away, that you can kind of pull it off with certain meats, particularly organ meats, particularly liver. Yeah. I mean, liver is like the biggest multivitamin on the planet in a sense. I mean, it is, there's really nothing like it.
Yeah, the organ meats are astonishing, really. And you may not need too much of them in a very balanced, broad, mixed diet. But certainly they're the true superfoods. And I guess the plant-based generally, I mean, if you can add in eggs or cheese and certainly some fish, not a huge amount into that. Now you're getting there. But I know what you mean. Hardcore 100% plants just requires a lot of skill and judgment and knowing your science and making sure you're replete. So the financial impact then, just personally, we mentioned this also earlier, in terms of your current status, your business, what you're doing, are there actual impacts on you financially? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I'm comfortable sharing this in that much of my research is driven, even though I've been basically doing this 24/7, much of my research is driven by the full knowledge that at any point in time, I could drop everything I'm doing and do contract work. And that's always felt like a kind of parachute that I already had that not a lot of other people have. It's great to be a software engineer in general, because there seems to always be more than enough work to choose from in a pinch. If you've, you know, got to suddenly step out and try to look for gigs, much less take on another, like say directorship role, like I'd had from before. That said, obviously now the times have changed. If I'm in a situation where I'm in a much bigger financial crunch, then that's going to be a new concern. I don't know that I would be able to find work quite as easy. And I think many other people in a contractor role would understand exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's going to be on a lot of people's minds and is a huge factor. Obviously, suffering and debt is the enormous factor, but so many businesses are going to be hit. And that will lead to so many difficult positions for so many people that there is a health and suffering aspect to that too, which if things aren't managed very well, you know, like proper engineering crisis management, if you will, you know, that vector could get enormous in its own right if you scale it.
let's just be upfront, or at least this is my opinion. My opinion is it's already going to feel much more enormous than a while ago. And I don't want to say that to create panic. On the contrary, I actually want to say these kinds of things to help mitigate it. The more that we know, you know, it's like if you're going into the doctor and the doctor says, hey, we're going to, given everything that we've come to understand, you're going to have to take some tough steps and it may even require surgery. Let's talk out all the options. And after you talk out all the options, even those steps that don't require surgery are still going to bring around some hardship that you just never anticipated. That's going to be difficult to deal with. But the sooner you can start absorbing what those choices are and that there will be some hardship, the better you can get at recognizing that, okay, this is just something that's going to have to happen. We're going to have to deal with it as people, but there's still going to be light on the other side. There's still going to be a point where we do get control of it. Maybe we also have to deal with the pain of uncertainty, because that's some of the worst pain there is not knowing, you know, what's going to happen next. That's difficult for us to work with. But all that said, can we anticipate there's at least that much ahead, that there's going to be a lot of uncertainty and that there's going to be a lot of suffering and unfortunately a lot of mortality? Yeah, we have enough information now. Certainly, I'm quite convinced that that's the more likely of the scenarios in front of us.
Yeah, and we got to keep in mind too that the show goes on, and that is just really important as well. I think... can I make a compare to the wartime World War II era people, you know? Yeah, but I think people have changed too, and just the way our modern world is, sometimes, you know, you need to have this tenacity, old style kind of, I don't know, robustness too. We've got to accept challenges, but equally we got to step up and face them. I have that feeling. There was a 1957 flu epidemic which killed, I think, 1.5 million around the world. 1957. And I didn't know about that until the other day. I always knew about the 2018. It killed, I think, a few hundred thousand in America when the population is half what it is now. And it actually was very different than this coronavirus. Because this one is, as we described earlier, massively stacked to the older and the people with other conditions. And so was 57, but there was one huge exception. 57 had an enormous tail of young people, 15 and younger. So the distribution of the 57 had young people and then a massive tail for old people and sick people. And this one seems to overwhelmingly have more the tail for the older. So, you know, in 57, it looks that they sustained quite a lot. And they had no technology back then, like you described a while ago. We have vast technology, tracking, testing, treatments, you know, coordination. So, yeah, you know, we'll get through this, I think, might be my final words.
We will. And, you know, if I can have a final word, I try to always emphasize this in the positive end, which is my favorite number in all of this is 100. 100 is the percent of time that we as a species have gotten through a pandemic, ultimately regained our footing, and ultimately found our way towards a better life, actually improved upon how it is that we handled not only crises before, but also how we improved our lives in the long run. But again, it's a long run thing, and we have to always keep our mind on what's ahead.
Very good, Dave. And that's a great way to wrap it up. And you know, we might check back in a while because we have this amazing technology that we can get together anytime. And when things develop in the next week or so, we might check back in and look at how the numbers are looking, how people are bearing up. So thanks a lot, Dave.
Thanks for having me, Ivor.
Good man. Bye now. Thanks for tuning in, guys. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see my subscribe button in the middle of the screen, a free viewing of the Widowmaker movie on the far right, and myself and Dr. Gerber's book, Eat Rich, Live Long, on the left. Otherwise, please do subscribe to the audio podcast. Thanks.